Chapter 9. It was in latitude 89 east that the frigate caught them. A string of lights had been seen towards the end of the middle watch, and as the sun came up, most of the Surprise's people were on deck to contemplate the cloud of sails that stretched along the horizon, 39 ships and a brig in two separate bodies. They had scattered somewhat in the night, and now they were closing up in response to their Commodore's signals, the laggards crowding sail on the moderate northeast breeze. The Leeward Division, if such a wandering heap could be called a division, was made up of country ships bound for Calcutta, Madras, or Bombay, and some foreigners who had joined them for safety from pirates and to profit by their exact navigation. It straggled for 3 miles along the distant sea. But those to windward, all 16 of them, the larger kind of Indiamen that made the uninterrupted voyage from Canton to London, were already in a formation that would not have done much discredit to the navy.
"And are you indeed fully persuaded that they are not men of war?" asked Mr. White. "They look wonderfully like, with their rows of guns, wonderfully like to a landsman's eye."
"They do they not?" said Stephen. "It is their study so to appear. But I believe that if you look closer, you will see water butts placed, stowed between the guns, and a variety of bales on deck which would never be countenanced in the service, and the various flags and streams that fly in the appropriate places are quite different. I am not prepared to say just in what the difference lies, but to the seamen it is instantly apparent they are not the royal insignia. Then again, you will have noticed that the captain has given orders to close them, which I conceive he would scarcely have done had they been an enemy fleet of such magnitude."
"He said, 'Keep your luff,' and followed it with an oath," said the chaplain, narrowing his eyes.
"It is all one," said Stephen. "They speak in tropes at sea."
From his perch in the main crosstrees, Pullings summoned William Church aloft, a very small midshipman in his first voyage who seemed rather to have shrunk than to have grown in the course of it.
"Now, Yonker," he said, "you are always nattering about the wealth of the Orient and the way you never see none of it in Bombay, nor parts east, but only mud and flies and a mortal lot of sea. Well, now, just take a look through this spyglass at the ship wearing the pendant. She's the Lushington. I made 2 voyages in her. Then next astern there's the Worley, a very sweet sailor, works herself almost, and fast for an Indiaman. Trim lines, you could take her for a heavy frigate if you'd not been aboard. You see they carry forestaysails, just as we do. They are the only merchantmen you will ever see with a forestaysail. Some call it impertinence. And then the one with her topsail atrip, that they are making such a cock of trimming. Judas Priest, what a Hornchurch fare. They forgot to pass the staysail sheet. You see the mate and the passion are running along the gangway? I can hear him from here. It's always the same with these Lascars. They are tolerable good seamen sometimes, but they forget their ABC, and they can't be got to do their duty brisk. No, not if it is ever so. Then on her quarter, with the patched inner jib, that's the Hope. Or maybe she's the Ocean, they're much of a muchness, out of the same yard and off of the same draught. But anyway, all of them you see in this weather line is what we call 1,200 tonners. That'll be sure some gauges 13 and even 1,500 ton. Thames measurement. Wexford there, with her brass forecastle 8-pounder winking in the sun, she does. But we call her a 1,200-ton ship."
"Sir, might it not be simpler to call her a 1,500-ton ship?"
"Simpler, maybe, but it would never do. You don't want to be upsetting the old ways. Oh, dear me, no. God's my life. If the captain was to hear you carrying on in that reckless, Jacobin, democratical line, why, I dare say he would turn you adrift on a 3-inch plank, with both your ears nailed down to it, to learn you bashfulness, the way he served 3 young gentlemen in the Med. No, no, you don't want to go arsing around with the old ways. The French did so, and look at the scrape it has gotten them into. But what I called you up here for was to show you this here wealth of the Orient. Just you look ahead of the Commodore to the leading ship, Ganges, if I don't mistake, and now cast your eye to old Slow Belly in the rear, setting his t'gallants and sagging to leeward something cruel. Look hard now, because you will not likely see such a sight again, for there you have a clear 6 millions of money, not counting the officer's private ventures. 6 million of money. God love us, what a prize!"
The officers who were wafting this enormous treasure across the ocean in their leisurely East India fashion were well rewarded for doing so. This pleased them because, among other things, it allowed them to be magnificently hospitable, and they were the most hospitable souls afloat. No sooner had Captain Muffet, the Commodore, made out the frigate's tall mainmast in the light of dawn than he sent for his chief steward, his head Chinese, and his head Indian cook, and signals broke out aboard the Lushington, the one to the Surprise: "Request honour of captains and officers' company to dinner, the other to the convoy, All ships, pretty young female passengers required, dine frigates officers. Repeat, young, repeat, pretty. The Surprise ran within a cable's length of the Lushington. Boats plied to and fro along the fleet, bringing young women in silk dresses and eager officers in blue and gold. The Indiaman's splendid stateroom was filled with people, filled with cheerful noise, news of Europe, of India and the Farther East, news of the war, of common acquaintances, gossip, inane but cheerful conversation, riddles, toasts to the Royal Navy, to the Honourable East India Company, to trade's increase, and the frigate's officers filled themselves with splendid food, with charming wine. Mr. Church's neighbour, a lovely rounded creature with golden hair, treated him with the attentive respect due to his uniform, urging him to try a little more of this lacquered duck, a trifle of pork, a few more slices of pineapple, calling for Canton buns, exchanging her third plate of pudding with him. No one would notice. But even her overflowing goodwill sought to restrain his hand at last. It sought in vain. Church had secured to himself a cake in the form of the Kuan Yin Pagoda. There were 8 stories still to go, and his beloved captain's motto was, "Lose not a minute." He lost none in small talk, at all events, but silently ate on and on. She looked anxiously round, gazed at the frigate's surgeon, sitting in moody silence opposite her, but found no help. When the ladies withdrew, instantly followed by Babington, who muttered something about his handkerchief being left in the boat, she paused by the Lushington's chief officer and said, "Pray, sir, take care of the blue child. I am sure he will do himself a mischief." She watched him apprehensively as he went down the side, but her eye could not follow nor her heart conceive his rapid progress from the frigate's deck to the midshipman's berth, where those who had been obliged to stay aboard were sitting down to a feast sent across by the Indiaman. For his part, Jack could not manage a second dinner when he reached the Surprise again, nor indeed anything of a solid nature, but throwing off his coat, neckcloth, waistcoat and breeches, he called for nankeen trousers and coffee.
"You will join me in another pot, Stephen," he said. "Lord, how delightful it is to have room to move."
The envoy's suite, apart from Mr. White, who was too poor to pay his passage, had removed into an Indiaman, and the great cabin was itself again.
"And how glad I am to be shot of that wicked little scrub, Atkins."
"He was a nuisance, but he was not a wicked man. Weak he was, and silly."
"When you say weak, you say all the rest. You are much too inclined to find excuses for scrubs, Stephen. You preserved that ill-conditioned brute Scriven from the gallows, nourished him in your bosom, gave him your countenance, and who paid for it? J. Aubrey paid for it. Here is the coffee. After such a dinner, your soul calls out for coffee. A most capital dinner, upon my word. The duck was the best I have ever tasted."
"I was sorry to see you help yourself to him a fourth time. Duck is a melancholy meat. In any case, the rich sauce in which it bathed was not at all the thing for a subject of your corpulence. Apoplexy lurks in dishes of that kind. I signalled to you, but you did not attend."
"Is that why you were looking so mumchance?"
"I was displeased with my neighbours, too."
"The nymphs in green? Delightful girls."
"It is clear you have been a great while at sea. To call those sandy-haired, coarse-featured, pimply, short-necked, thick-fingered, vulgar-minded, lubricious blockheads by such a name. Nymphs, forsooth. If they were nymphs, they must have had their being in a tolerably rank and stagnant pool. The wench on my left had an ill breath, and turning for relief I found her sister had a worse, and the upper garment of neither was free from reproach. Worse lay below, I make no doubt. 'La, sister,' cries the one to the other, breathing across me, vile teeth, and 'La, sister,' cries the other. I have no notion of two sisters wearing the same clothes, the same flaunting meretricious gauds, the same tortured gorgon curls low over their brutish criminal foreheads. It bespeaks a superfetation of vulgarity, both innate and studiously acquired. And when I think that their teeming loins will people the East. Pray pour me out another cup of coffee. Confident brutes!" He might have added that these young ladies had instantly started to talk to him about a Mrs. Villiers of Bombay, who had just reached Calcutta. The doctor must have heard of her in Bombay. She was nothing but an adventuress. How dreadful. They had seen her at the governor's, dressed very outré, not at all good-looking. They wondered at the reports. People were obliged to receive her and pretend not to know, because her gentleman friend, say protector, sister, was vastly important, lived in the highest style, quite princely. It was said she was ruining him. He was a vastly genteel creature, tall, such an air and address, you would almost think he was one of us. He had looked at Aggie in such a particular way. They both tittered in their balled-up, grubby handkerchiefs, slapping one another behind his bowed back. He was turning it over in his mind, whether to say, "These women spoke malignantly about Diana Villiers, which angered me. I asked her to marry me in Bombay, and I am to have her reply in Calcutta. I have meant to tell you this for some time. Candor required such a statement earlier. I trust you will forgive my apparent lack of candor." When Jack said,
"Well, and so you did not altogether like them, I collect. I'm sorry for it. My neighbour and I agreed wonderfully well. Muffet, I mean. The girl my other side was a ninny hammer. No bosom. I thought these girls with no bosoms were exploded long ago. I took to him amazingly. A thoroughgoing seaman, not at all the usual company's commander. Not that I mean to imply they are not seamen, but they are rather pianissimo, if you know what I mean."
"I know what pianissimo means."
"He has exactly my idea about stepping the royal mast abaft the t'gallant with its heel on the top cap. He actually has it rigged so, as I dare say you noticed, and swears it gives him an extra knot in moderate airs. I'm determined to try it. He is an excellent fellow. He promised to put our packet aboard a pilot boat the moment he was in soundings."
"I wish you may have desired Sophie to come to Madeira," muttered Stephen.
"And he has some notions of gunnery, too, which is rare enough even in the Navy. He does his best to exercise his people, but he is most pitifully equipped, poor fellow."
"There seemed to me a formidable array of guns, more than we possess, if I do not mistake."
"They were not guns, my poor Stephen. They were cannonades."
"What are cannonades?"
"Why, they are cannonades, medium 18s. How can I explain? You know a carronade, I am sure."
"Certainly I do. The short thing on slides, ignoble in its proportions, that throws an immense ball. I have noticed several about the ship."
"What a lynx you are, upon my honour. Nothing escapes you. And clearly you know a cannon, a great gun. Well, now, conceive of an unlucky bastard cross between the two, something that weighs a mere 2,800 weight and jumps in the air and breaks its breeching every time you offer to fire it, and that will not strike true at 500 yards. No, not at 50. And there you have your cannonade. But even if the company had some notion of its own interests and gave him real guns, who is to fire them off? He would need 350 men, and what has he got? 140, most of them cooks and stewards, and Lascar cooks and stewards at that. Dear Lord above, what a way to trundle 6 millions about the world! Yet he has sound views on stepping a royal. I am determined to try it, if only on the foremast."
2 days later, the Surprise, alone on a misty, heaving sea, was trying it. The carpenter and his crew had wrought all morning, and now, dinner having been cut short, the long mast was swaying up through the intricate tracery of the rigging. This was a delicate task in a heavy swell, and Jack had not only heaved to, but he had stopped the midday grog. He wanted no fuddled enthusiasm heaving on the top rope, and he knew very well that the delay would stimulate zeal, that no one would put up with a moment's dawdling, that no man would presume to pause to gasp in the oppressive, thundery heat, for fear of what his mates would do. Up and up it went, and peering with half-closed eyes into the glare of the covered sun, he guided it inch by inch, coordinating the successive heaves with the pitching of the ship. The last half-foot, and the whole ship's company held its breath, eyes fixed on the heel of the mast. It crept a little higher, the new top rope creaking in the block and sending down a cloud of shakings. Then, with a jerk and a shudder along its whole length, the heel lifted over the top cap.
"Handsomely! Handsomely!"
cried Jack. A trifle more. At the masthead the boatswain flung up his hand.
"Lower away!"
The top rope slackened. The heel of the mast settled down inside the step. And it was done. The Surprises let out a universal sigh. The main topsail and forecourse dropped like the curtain at the end of a harrowing drama. They were sheeted home, and the boatswain piped belay. The frigate answered at once, and as he felt the way on her, Jack gazed up at the new royal mast, rigidly parallel with the t'gallant, and rising high above with a splendid promise of elastic strength. He felt a dart of pure joy, not merely because of the mast, nor because of the sweet motion of the ship, his own dear ship, nor yet because he was afloat and in command. It was a plenitude of being.
"On deck there!"
called the lookout in a hesitant, deprecating howl.
"Sail on the larboard bow! 2, maybe!"
Hesitant because reporting the China fleet for a third time was absurd, deprecating because he should have done so long ago, instead of staring at the perilous drama of the mast. His hail excited little interest or none. Grog was to be served out the moment the mast was secured and the yard across. Willing hands, well ahead of orders, were busy with the two pair of shrouds, the stoppings on the yard. Impatient men were waiting in the cross trees, ready to clap on the braces. However, Jack and his first lieutenant looked attentively at the hazy ships, looming unnaturally large some 4 miles ahead, and growing rapidly clearer as the frigate sailed towards them. She was making 5 knots already on the steady northeast wind.
"Who is that old-fashioned fellow who carries his mizzen topmast staysail under the maintop?" said Starton. "I believe I can make out 2 more behind them. I'm astonished they should have come up with us so soon. After all—"
"Starton! Starton!" cried Jack. "It is Lenoir! Haul your wind, hard aport, hard over! Let fall the main course there, strike the pendant, fore staysail, main t'gallant! Marines, marines there! Clap on to the main brace! Bear a hand, bear a hand! Mr. Etheridge, stir up your men!"
Babington came running aft to report the fore-royal yard across, and the frigate's sudden turn, coinciding with a heavy roll, threw him off his balance. He fell sprawling at his captain's feet.
"Butcher!" cried Jack. "Mr. Babington, this is carrying a proper deference too far."
"Yard across, sir, if you please," said Babington, and seeing the wild glee on Jack's face, the mad brilliance of his eye, he presumed on their old acquaintance to say, "Sir, what's afoot?"
"Lenoir is afoot," said Jack, with a grin. "Mr. Sarton, backstays to that mast at once, and preventers! Do not let them set up the shrouds too taut. We must not have it rung. All stunsails and kites into the tops. Give her what sail she can carry, and then I believe you may prepare to clear for action."
Slinging his glass, he ran up the masthead like a boy. The Surprise had spun round on her heel. She was now steadying on her course, close-hauled and heading north, leaning far over to larboard as the sail increased upon her and her bow wave began to fling the water wide. The Frenchmen were fading a little in the haze, but he could see the nearest signalling. Both had been sailing on a course designed to intercept the Surprise. They had seen him first, and now they were following his turn in chase. They would never fetch his wake unless they tacked, however. They had been too far ahead for that. Beyond them he could make out a larger ship, another farther to the southwest, and something indistinct on the blurred horizon, perhaps a brig. These three were still sailing large, and clearly the whole squadron had been in line abreast, strung out to sweep 20 miles of sea, and they were standing directly for the path the slow China fleet would traverse next day. Thunder had been grumbling and crashing since the morning, and now in the midst of a distant peal there was the sound of a gun, the Admiral, no doubt, calling in his leeward ships.
"Mr. Starton," he called, "Dutch ensign and 2 or 3 hoists of the first signal flags that come to hand, with a gun to windward. 2 guns.
The French frigates were cracking on. T'gallant staysails appeared, outer jib, jib of jibs. They were throwing up a fine bow wave, and the first was making perhaps 8 knots, the second 9. But the distance was drawing out, and that would never do. His very first concern was to find out what he had to deal with. Below him the deck was like an anthill disturbed, and he could hear the crash of the carpenter's mallets below as the cabin bulkheads came down. It would be some minutes before the apparent confusion resolved itself into a trim, severe pattern, a clean sweep fore and aft, the guns cast loose, their crews standing by them, every man at his station, sentries at the hatchways, damp fear-naught screens rigged over the magazines, wet sand strewn over the decks. The men had been through these motions hundreds of times, but never in earnest. How would they behave in action? Pretty well, no doubt. Most men did, in this kind of action, if they were properly led. And the Surprises were a decent set of men, a little over-eager with their shot at first, perhaps, but that could be dealt with. How much powder was there filled? 20 rounds apiece was yesterday's report, and plenty of wads. Hales was a good, conscientious gunner. He would be as busy as a bee at this moment down there in the powder-room. This drawing away would never do. He would give them another 2 minutes and then take his measures. The second frigate had passed the first. She was almost certainly the 36-gun Semillante, with 12-pounders on her main deck. The Surprise could take her on. He moved out onto the yardarm for a better view, for they lay on his quarter, and it was difficult to count the gun ports. Yes, she was the Semillante, and the heavy frigate behind her was the Belle Poule, 40, with 18-pounders. A very tough nut to crack if she was well handled. He watched them dispassionately. Yes, they were well handled. Both somewhat crank, probably from want of stores, and both slow, of course. They must be trailing a great curtain of weed after so many months in this milk-warm water, and they were making heavy weather of it. Beautiful ships, however, and their people obviously knew their duty. Semillante sheeted home her for-topmast staysail in a flash. In his opinion, Belle Poule would do better with less canvas abroad. Her for-t'gallant seemed to be pressing her down, but no doubt her captain knew her trim best. Braithwaite appeared, snorting.
"Mr. Starton's duty, sir, and the ship is cleared for action. Do you choose he should beat to quarters, sir?"
No, Mr. Braithwaite, said Jack, considering. There was no question of action yet a while, and it would be a pity to keep the men standing about. No, but pray tell him I should like sail to be discreetly reduced. Come up the bowlands a trifle and give the sheets half a fathom or so. Nothing obvious, you understand me. And the old number three for topsail is to be bent to a hawser and veered out of the lee stern port.
Aye, aye, sir, said Braithwaite, and vanished.
A few moments later the frigate's speed began to slacken, and as the strain came on to the drag sail, opening like a parachute beneath the surface, it dropped further still. Stephen and the chaplain stood at the taffrail, staring over the larboard quarter.
"I'm afraid they are coming closer," said Mr. White. "I can distinctly see the men on the front of the nearer one, and even on the ship behind. See, they fire a gun, and a flag appears. Your glass, if you please. Why, it is the English flag. I congratulate you, Dr. Maturin. I congratulate you on our deliverance. I confess I had apprehended a very real danger, a most unpleasant situation. They are our friends."
"Haud crede colori," said Stephen. "Cast your eyes aloft, my dear sir."
Mr. White looked up at the mizzen peak, where a tricolour streamed out bravely.
"It is the French flag," he cried. "No, the Dutch. We are sailing under false colours. Can such things be?"
"So are they," said Stephen. "They seek to amuse us. We seek to amuse them. The iniquity is evenly divided. It is an accepted convention, I find, like bidding the servant—"
A shot from the Semillon's bow chaser threw up a plume of water a little way from the frigate's stern, and the parson started back.
"Say you are not at home, when in fact you are eating muffin by your fire, and do not choose to be disturbed."
"I often did so," said Mr. White, whose face had grown strangely mottled. "God forgive me. And now here I am in the midst of battle. I never thought such a thing could happen. I am a man of peace. However, I must not give a bad example."
A ball, striking the top of a wave, ricocheted onto the quarterdeck by way of the neatly piled hammocks. It fell with a harmless dump, and two midshipmen darted for it, struggled briefly until the stronger wrested it away and wrapped it lovingly in his jacket.
"Good heavens," cried Mr. White, "to fire great iron balls at people you have never even spoken to. Barbarity has come again."
"Will you take a turn, sir?"
asked Stephen.
"Willingly, sir, if you do not think I should stand here, to show I do not care for those ruffians. But I bow to your superior knowledge of warfare. Will the captain stay up there on the mast, in that exposed position?"
"I dare say he will," said Stephen. "I dare say he is turning over the situation in his mind."
Certainly he was. It was clear that his first duty, having reconnoitred the enemy, was to reach the China fleet and do everything possible to preserve it. Nor had he the least doubt that he could outsail the Frenchmen with their foul bottoms. Indeed, even if they had been clean, he could no doubt have given them a good deal of canvas, fine ships though they were, for it was they who had built the Surprise, and he who was sailing her. It stood to reason that an Englishman could handle a ship better than a Frenchman. Yet Lenoir was not to be underestimated, the fox. He had chased Jack in the Mediterranean through a long summer's day, and he had caught him. The two-decker, now so near that her identity was certain, the Marengo, 74, wearing a rear admiral's flag, had worn, and now she was close-hauled on the larboard tack, followed by the fourth ship and the distant brig. The fourth ship must be the Berceau, a 22-gun corvette. The brig he knew nothing about. Lenoir had worn. He had not tacked. That meant he was favouring his ship. Those three, the Marengo, Berceau, and the brig, standing on the opposite tack, meant to cut him off, if the frigates managed to head him. That was obvious. Greyhounds either side of a hare turning her. The last shot came a little too close. Excellent practice at this extreme range. It would be a pity to have any ropes cut away.
"Mr. Starton," he called, "shake out a reef in the foretopsail and haul the bowlines."
The Surprise leapt forward in spite of her drag sail. The Semillante was leaving the Belle Poule far behind, and to leeward. He knew that he could draw her on and on, then bear up suddenly and bring her to close action, hammer her hard with his 32-pounder carronades, and perhaps sink or take her before her friends could come up. The temptation made his breath come short. Glory, and the only prize in the Indian Ocean. The pleasing image of billowing smoke, the flash of guns, masts falling, faded almost at once, and his heart returned to its dutiful, calculating pace. He must not endanger a single spar. His frigate must join the China fleet at all costs, and intact. His present course was taking Lenoir straight towards the Indiaman, half a day's sail away to the east, strung out over miles of sea, quite unsuspecting. Clearly he must lead the Frenchman away by some lame duck ruse, even if it meant losing his comfortable weather gauge, lead them away until nightfall, and then beat up, trusting to the darkness and the surprise's superior sailing to shake them off and reach the convoy in time. He could go about and head southeast until about 10 o'clock. By then he should have forereached upon Lenoir so far that he could bear up, cross ahead of him in the darkness, and so double back. Yet if he did so, or offered to do so, Lenoir, that deep old file, might order the pursuing frigates to hold on to their northerly course, stretching to windward of the surprise and gaining the weather gauge. That would be awkward in the morning, for fast though she was, she could not outrun Semillant and Belle Poule if they were sailing large, and she was beating up, as she would have to beat up, tack after tack, to warn the China fleet. But then again, if Lenoir did that, if he ordered his frigates northwards, a gap would appear in his dispositions after a quarter of an hour's sailing, a gap through which the surprise could dart, bearing up suddenly and running before the wind with all the sail she could spread, and passing between the Belle Poule and the Marengo, out of range of either, for Lenoir's dispositions were based upon the chase moving at 9 or 10 knots. No European ship in these waters could do better, and hitherto surprise had not done as well. Berceau, the corvette, farther to leeward, might close the gap, but although she might knock away some of his spars, it was unlikely that she could hold him long enough for the Marengo to come up. If she had a commander so determined that he would let his ship be riddled, perhaps sunk, a man who would run him aboard, why then that would be a different matter. He looked hard over the sea at the distant corvette. She vanished in a drift of rain, and he shifted his gaze to the two-decker. What was in Lenoir's mind? He was running east-southeast under easy sail, topsails, forecourse clewed up. One thing Jack was certain of was that Lenoir was infinitely more concerned with catching the China fleet than with destroying a frigate. The moves. The answers to those moves on either side. The varying degrees of danger, and above all Lenoir's appreciation of the position. He came down on deck, and Stephen, looking attentively at him, saw that he had what might be called his battle face. It was not the glowing blaze of immediate action, of boarding or cutting out, but a remoter expression altogether. Cheerful, confident, but withdrawn, filled with natural authority. He did not speak, apart from giving an order to hitch the runners to the mastheads and to double the preventer backstays, but paced the quarter-deck with his hands behind his back, his eyes running from the frigates to the line of battleship. Stephen saw the first lieutenant approach, hesitate, and step back. On these occasions, he reflected, my valuable friend appears to swell, actually to increase in his physical as well as his spiritual dimensions. Is it an optical illusion? How I should like to measure him! The penetrating intelligence in the eye, however, is not capable of measurement. He becomes a stranger. I, too, should hesitate to address him.
Mr. Starton, said Jack, we will go about.
Yes, sir. Shall I cast off the drag sail, sir?
No, and we will not go about too fast, neither. Space out the orders, if you please.
As the pipes screeched, all hands about ship, he stood on the hammocks, fixing the Marengo with his glass, pivoting as the frigate turned up into the wind. Just after the cry of mainsail haul and the sharp cutting pipe of belay, he saw a signal run up aboard the flagship and the puff of a gun on her poop. The Semillant and the Belle Poule had begun their turn in pursuit, but now the Semillant paid off again and stood on. The Belle Poule was already past the eye of the wind when a second gun emphasized the order to stand on northwards and gain the weather gauge, and she had to wear right round to come up onto her former tack.
Damn that, murmured Jack.
The blunder would narrow his precious gap by quarter of a mile. He glanced at the sun and at his watch.
Mr. Church, he said, be so good as to fetch me a mango.
The minutes passed. The juice ran down his chin. The French frigates stood on to the north-northwest, growing smaller. First the Semillant and then the Belle Poule crossed the wake of the surprise, gaining the weather gauge. There was no changing his mind now. The Marengo, her two tiers of guns clearly to be seen, lay on the starboard beam, sailing a parallel course. There was no sound but the high, steady note of the wind in the rigging and the beat of the sea on the frigate's larboard bow. The far-spaced ships scarcely seemed to move in relation to one another from one minute to the next. There seemed to be all the peaceful room in the world. The Marengo dropped her foresail. The angle widened half a degree. Jack checked all the positions yet again, looked at his watch, looked at the dog vane, and said,
"Mr. Starton, the stunsails are in the tops, I believe?"
"Yes, sir."
"Very well. In 10 minutes we must cast off the drag sail, bear up, set royals, stunsails aloft and alow if she will bear them, and bring the wind 2 points on the quarter. We must make sail as quick as ever sail was made, brailing up the driver and hauling down the staysails at the same time, of course. Send Clark and Bondon to the wheel. Lower the starboard port lids. Make all ready and stand by to let go the drag sail when I give the signal."
Still the minutes dropped by. The critical point was coming. But slowly, slowly. Jack, motionless upon that busy deck, began to whistle softly as he watched the far-off Linois. But then he checked himself. He wanted no more than a brisk to gallant breeze. Anything more, or anything like a hollow sea, would favour the two-decker, the tall, far heavier ship, and he knew to his cost how fast those big French 74s could move. A last glance to windward. The forces were exactly balanced. The moment had come. He drew a deep breath, tossed the hairy mango stone over the side, and shouted,
"Let go there!"
An instant splash.
"Hard a port!"
The Surprise turned on her heel, her yards coming round to admiration, sails flashing out as others vanished, and there, close on her starboard quarter, was her foaming wake showing a sweet, tight curve. She leapt forward with a tremendous new impulse, her masts groaning, and settled on her new course, not deviating by a quarter of a point. She was heading exactly where he had wanted her to head, straight for the potential gap, and she was moving even faster than he had hoped. The higher spars were bending like coach whips, just this side of carrying away.
"Mr. Starton, that was prettily executed. I am very pleased."
The Surprise was tearing through the water, moving faster and faster until she reached a steady 11 knots, and the masts ceased their complaint. The backstays grew a shade less rigid, and leaning on one, gauging its tension as he stared at the Marengo, he said,
"Main in for royal stunsails."
The Marengo was brisk in her motions, well manned, but the move had caught her unawares. She did not begin her turn until the Surprise had set her royal stunsails and her masts were complaining again as they drove her 500 tons even faster through the sea. Her deck leaning sharply, her lee headrails buried in the foam, the sea roaring along her side and the hands standing mute. Never a sound fore and aft. Yet when the Marengo did turn, she bore up hard to bring the wind on her starboard quarter, settling on a course that would give her beautiful deep-cut sails all possible thrust to intercept the Surprise at some point in the southwest. To cut her off, that is to say, if she could not find another knot or so. At the same time, the flagship sent up hoist after hoist of signals, some directed, no doubt, at the still invisible corvette to leeward, and others to bring the Semillant and the Belle Poule pelting down after the Surprise.
"They will never do it, my friend," said Jack. "They did not send up double preventer stays 30 minutes ago. They cannot carry royals in this breeze."
But he touched a belaying pin as he said this. Royals or no, the situation was tolerably delicate. The Marengo was moving faster than he had expected, and the Belle Poule, whose earlier mistake had set her well to leeward, was nearer than he could wish. The two-decker and the heavy frigate were the danger. He had no chance at all against the Marengo, very little against the Belle Poule, and both these ships were fast converging upon his course. Each came on, surrounded by an invisible ring 2 miles and more in diameter, the range of their powerful guns. The Surprise had to keep well out of these rings, above all out of the area where they would soon overlap, and the lane was closing fast. He considered her trim with the most intense concentration. It was possible that he was pressing her down a trifle aft, that there was a little too much canvas abroad, driving her by force rather than by love.
"Haul up the weather skirt of the main course," he said.
Just so. That was distinctly sweeter, a more airy motion altogether. The dear Surprise had always loved her headsails.
"Mr. Babington, jump forward and tell me whether the spritsail will stand."
"I doubt it, sir," said Babington, coming aft. "She throws such an almighty bow wave."
Jack nodded. He had thought as much.
"Spritsail topsail, then,"
he said, and thanked God for his new strong royal mast that would take the strain. How beautifully she answered. You could ask anything of her. Yet still the lane was narrow enough in all conscience. The Marengo was crowding sail, and now the Surprise was racing into the zone of high danger.
"Mr. Callow," he said to the signal midshipman, "strike the Dutch colours. Hoist our own ensign and the pendant."
The ensign broke out at the mizzen peak. A moment later, the pendant, the mark of a man of war and no other, streamed from the main. The surprise was particular about her pendant, had renewed it 4 times, this commission, adding a yard or two each time, and now its slim, tapering flame stretched out 60 feet, curving away beyond her starboard bow. At the sight there was a general hum of satisfaction along the deck, where the men stood tense, strongly moved by the tearing speed. Now he was almost within random shot of the Marengo's bow guns. If he edged away, the Belle Poule and the Semillante would gain on him. Could he afford to hold on to this present course?
"Mr. Braithwaite," he said to the master's mate, "be so good as to heave the log."
Braithwaite stepped forward, paused for a moment at the sloping lee quarter to see where he could toss it into a calm patch outside the mill race rushing along her side, flung the log wide through the flying spray, and shouted, "Turn!" The boy, posted on the hammock netting with a reel, held it high. The line tore off, and a moment later there was a shriek. The quartermaster had the boy by 1 foot, dragging him inward, and the reel, torn from his hand, raced away astern.
"Fetch another log, Mr. Braithwaite,"
said Jack, with intense satisfaction,
"and use a 14-second glass."
He had seen the whole line run off the reel only once in his life, when he was a midshipman homeward bound in the packet from Nova Scotia, and the Flying Childers boasted of having done it too. The Childers also claimed to have lost their boy. But this was no time to be regretting the preservation of young Puddinghead, Bent Larson, for although it was clear that at this speed they would do it, that they would cross the Marengo and start to increase the distance within a few minutes, yet nevertheless they were running towards the nearest point of convergence, and it was always possible to mistake by a few hundred yards. And some French long brass eights threw a ball very far and true. Would Lenoir fire? Yes. There was the flash and the puff of smoke. The ball fell short. The line was exact, but having skipped 5 times, the ball sank 300 yards away. So did the next 2, and the 4th was even farther off. They were through, and now every minute sailed carried them farther out of range.
"Yet I must not discourage him," said Jack, altering course to bring the surprise a little closer. "Mr. Starton, ease off the foresail sheet and hand the spritsail topsail. Mr. Callow, signal, enemy in sight, ship of the line, corvette and brig bearing east, 2 frigates bearing north-northwest. Request orders," with a gun to windward. "Keep it flying, and repeat the gun every 30 seconds. "Yes, sir. May I say the corvette is bearing southeast now?"
She was indeed. The lifting rainstorm showed her on the Surprise's larboard bow, well ahead of the Marengo and to leeward. The turning wind in the squall had set her 1/2 mile to the west. Grave. Grave. It was in the corvette's power to bring him to action, unless he edged away into the extreme range of the frigates. The Semillante had overhauled the Belle Poule once again, but to bring him to close action the corvette would have to stand his raking fire, and it would need a most determined commander to take his ship right in against such odds. He would probably bear up at long gunshot and exchange a distant broadside or two. Jack had no sort of objection to that. On the contrary, ever since he had set the Surprise for the gap, showing what she could really do in the way of speed, giving away her qualities, he had been trying to think of some means of leading Lenoir on in a hopeful chase that would take him far to the southward before nightfall. The signal was well enough in its way, but its effect would not last. The drag sail would scarcely take again. They must have smoked it, but a yard coming down with a run as though it had been shot away. Why, that would answer. And he could give any of them the mizzen, or even the main topsail.
"Mr. Babington, the corvette will engage us presently. When I give the word, let the main topsail come down with a run, as though her fire had had effect. But neither the yard nor the sail must be hurt. Some puddening on the cap, but I leave it to you. It must look like bedlam, all a-hoo, and yet still be ready to set."
It was just the kind of caper Babington would delight in. Jack had no doubt of his producing an elegant chaos, but he would have to go briskly to work. The Berceau was coming down under a cloud of canvas, as fast as ever she could run, and as Jack watched, he saw her set her ferroyal flying. She was steering to cross ahead of the Surprise. She lay on her beam at this moment, and although she was now within range, she held her fire.
"Mr. Babington," cried Jack, without taking his eyes from the Berceau, "should you like your hammock sent up?"
Babington slid down a backstay, scarlet with toil and haste.
"I'm sorry to have been so slow, sir," he said. "All is stretched along now, and I've left Harris and Old Reliable in the top with orders to keep out of sight and let go handsomely when hailed."
"Very good, Mr. Babington. Mr. Starton, let us beat to quarters."
At the thunder of the drum, Stephen took the startled chaplain by the arm and led him below.
"This is your place in action, my dear sir," he said in the dimness.
These are the chests upon which Mr. Mallister and I operate, and these, waving the lantern towards them, are the pledgets and tow and bandages with which you and Choles will second our endeavours. Does the sight of blood disturb you?"
"I have never seen it shed, in any quantity."
"Then here is a bucket, in case of need." Jack, Stourton, and Etheridge were on the quarter-deck. Harrowby stood a little behind them, conning the ship. The other officers were at the guns, each to his own division. Every man silently watched the Berceau as she ran down, a beautiful, trim little ship with scarlet topsides. She was head-on now, coming straight for the frigate's broadside, and Jack, watching closely through his glass, could see no sign of her meaning to bear up. The half-minute signal gun beside him spoke out again, and again, and again, and yet still the Berceau came on into the certainty of a murderous, raking fire. This was more determination than ever he had reckoned on. He had done the same himself in the Mediterranean, but that was against a Spanish frigate. Another 200 yards, and his heavy carronades would reach the Berceau point-blank. The signal gun again, and again.
"Belay there," he said, and much louder, "Mr. Pullings! Mr. Pullings! A steady, deliberate fire now! Let the smoke clear between each shot. Point low on her foremast."
A pause, and on the upward roll the purser's gun crashed out, the smoke sweeping ahead. A hole appeared in the corvette's spritsail, and a cheer went up, drowned by the second gun.
"Steady! Steady!" roared Jack,
and Pullings ran down the line to point the third. The ball splashed close to the corvette's bow, and as it splashed, she answered with a shot from her chaser that struck the mainmast a glancing blow. The fire came down the line, a rippling broadside. Two shots went home in the corvette's bows, another hit her chains, and there were holes in her foresail. Now it began forward again, and as the range narrowed, so they hit her hard with almost every shot, or swept her deck from stem to stern. There were two guns dismounted aboard her, and several men lying on the deck. Broadside after deliberate broadside, the whole ship quivering in the thunder, the jets of flame, the thick powder smoke racing ahead. Still the Berceau held on, though her way was checked, and now her bow guns answered with chain shot that shrieked high through the rigging, cutting ropes and sails as it went.
"A little more of this, and I shall not need my caper," thought Jack. "Can he mean to lay me aboard? Mr. Pullings, Mr. Babington, briskly now, and grape the next round. Mr. Etheridge, the marines may—"
His words were cut off by a furious cheer, and the Berceau's foretopmast was going. It gave a great forward lurch, the stays and shrouds parted, and it fell in a ruin of canvas, masking the corvette's forward guns.
"Hold hard!" he cried. "Main top there! Let go!"
The Surprise's topsail billowed out, came down, collapsed, and across the water they heard a thin answering cheer from the shattered corvette. A forward gun sent a hail of grape along the Berceau's deck, knocking down a dozen men and cutting away her colours.
"Cease fire there! God rot you all in hell!" cried Jack. "Secure those guns, Mr. Stourton, hands to knot and splice!"
"She's struck!" said a voice in the waist, as the Surprise swept on. The Berceau hulled again and again, low in the water and by the head, swung heavily round, and they saw a figure running up the mizzen shrouds with fresh colours. Jack took his hat off to her captain, standing there on his bloody quarter-deck 70 yards away. The Frenchman returned the salute, but still, as his remaining larboard guns came to bear, he fired a ragged broadside after the frigate, and then, as she reached the limit of his range, another, in a last attempt at preventing her escape. A vain attempt. Not a shot came home, and the Surprise was still far ahead of the Marengo on her larboard quarter, and the two frigates away to starboard. Jack glanced at the sun. No more than an hour to go, alas. He could not hope to lead them very far this moonless night, if indeed he could lead them at all for what was left of the day.
"Mr. Babington, take your party into the top and give the appearance of trying to get things ship-shape. You may cockbill the yard. Mr. Callow, where is that midshipman?"
"He was carried below, sir," said Stourton. "Hit on the head."
"Mr. Lee, then. Signal, partial engagement, heavy damage, request assistance. Enemy bearing north-northeast and north-northwest, and carry on with the half-minute gun. Mr. Stourton, a fire in the waist would do no harm, plenty of smoke. One of the coppers filled with slush and tow might answer. Let there be some turmoil."
He walked to the taffrail and surveyed the broad sea astern. The brig had gone to the assistance of the Berceau. The Marengo maintained her position on the larboard quarter, coming along at a fine pace and perhaps gaining a little. As he expected, she was signalling to the Semillon and the Belle Poule, a talkative nation, though gallant, and she was no doubt telling them to make more sail, for the Belle Poule set her main royal, which instantly carried away.
For the moment, everything was well in hand. He went below.
"Dr. Maturin," he said, "what is your casualty list?"
3 splinter wounds, sir. None serious, I'm happy to report, and 1 moderate concussion.
How is Mr. Callow?
There he is, on the floor. On the deck, just behind you. A block fell upon his head.
Shall you open his skull?
Asked Jack, with a vivid recollection of Stephen trepanning the gunner on the quarter-deck of the Sophie, exposing his brains to the admiration of all.
No, oh no. I'm afraid his condition would not justify the step. He will do very well as he is. Now Jenkins here had a truly narrow escape with his splinter when Malister and I cut it out.
"Which it came off of the hounds of the mainmast, sir,"
said Jenkins, holding up a wickedly sharp piece of wood, 2 feet long.
"We found his innominate artery pulsing against its tip. The 20th part of an inch more, or a trifling want of attention, and William Jenkins would have become an involuntary hero."
"Well done, Jenkins," said Jack. "Well done indeed."
And he went on to inquire after the other two, a forearm laid open and an ugly scalp wound.
"Is this Mr. White?"
catching sight of another body.
"Yes. He was a little overcome when we raised John Sadler's scalp and desired him to hold it while we sewed it on. Yet there was virtually no blood. A passing syncope. He will be quite recovered by a little fresh air. May he go on deck presently?"
"Oh, this minute, if he chooses. We had a slight brush with the corvette. Such a gallant fellow. He came on most amazingly until Mr. Bowes brought his foremast by the board, and now we are running before the wind, far out of range. Let him come on deck, by all means."
On deck, the black smoke was belching from the frigate's waist, streaming away ahead of her. The ship's boys were hurrying about with swabs, buckets, and the fire engine. Babington was roaring, cursing in the top, waving his arms. All hands looked pleased with themselves, and sly. And the pursuers had gained a quarter of a mile. Far on the starboard beam, the sun was sinking behind a blood-red haze. Sinking, sinking. And it was gone. Already the night was sweeping up from the east, the starless night, with no moon, and pale phosphorescent fire had begun to gleam in the frigate's wake. After sunset, when the French sails were no more than the faintest hint of whiteness far astern, to be fixed only by the recurrent flash of the Admiral's top lantern, the Surprise sent up a number of blue lights, set her undamaged main topsail, and ran fast and faster southwestwards. At 8 bells in the first watch, she hauled to the wind in the pitchy darkness, and having given his orders for the night, Jack said to Stephen,
"We must turn in and get what sleep we can. I expect a busy day tomorrow."
"Do you feel that Monsieur de Linois is not wholly deceived?"
"I hope he is, I am sure. He ought to be. And he has certainly come after us, as if he were. But he is a deep old file, a thoroughgoing seaman, and I shall be glad to see nothing to the east of us when we join the China fleet in the morning."
"Do you mean he might dart about and fling himself between us, guided by mere intuition? Surely that would argue a prescience in the Admiral exceeding the limits of our common humanity. A thoroughgoing seaman is not necessarily a seer. Attention to the nice adjustment of the sails is one thing, vaticination another. Honest, Jack, if you snore in that deep, pragmatical fashion, Sophie is going to spend many an uneasy night."
"It occurs to me," he said, looking at his friend, who, according to his long-established habit, had plunged straight into the dark, comfortable pit of sleep, from which nothing would rouse him but the cry of a sail or a change in the wind. "It occurs to me that our race must have a natural propensity to ugliness. You are not an ill-looking fellow, and were almost handsome before you were so pierced, blown up, and banged by the enemy, and so exposed to the elements, and you are to marry a truly beautiful young woman. Yet I make no doubt you will between you produce little common babies that mule, pule, and roar all in that same tedious, deeply vulgar, self-centred monotone, drool, cut their teeth, and grow up into plain blockheads, generation after generation, and no increase in beauty, none in intelligence. On the analogy of dogs, or even of horses, the rich should stand 9 foot high, and the poor run about under the table. This does not occur. Yet the absence of improvement never stops men desiring the company of beautiful women. Not indeed that when I think of Diana I have the least notion of children. I should never voluntarily add to the unhappiness of the world by bringing even more people into it, in any case. But even if that word in my mind, the idea of Diana as a mother is absurd. There is nothing maternal about her whatsoever. Her virtues are of another kind."
He turned the wick down to a small line of blue flame, and crept on to the steeply sloping deck, where he wedged himself between a coil of rope and the side, and watched the dim, tearing sea, the clearing sky with stars blazing in the gaps of cloud, reflecting upon Diana's virtues, defining them, and listening to the successive bells, the responding cry of "All's well!" right round the ship, until the first lightening of the eastern sky.
"I've brought you a mug of coffee, Doctor," said Pullings, looming at his side, "and when you have drunk it up, I'm going to call the skipper. He will be most uncommon pleased."
He still spoke in his quiet night-watch voice, although the idlers had been called already and the ship was filling with activity.
"What will please him so, Thomas Pullings? You are a good creature, to be sure, to bring me this reborative, stimulating drink. I am obliged to you. What will please him so? Why, the Indiamen's top-lights have been in sight this last glass and more, and when dawn comes up I dare say we shall see them a-shaking out the reef in their topsails, just exactly where he reckoned to find them. Such artful navigation you would scarcely credit. He has come at the Tom Cox's traverse over Lenoir."
Jack appeared, and the spreading light showed 40 sail of merchantmen stretched wide along the western sea. He smiled and opened his mouth to speak, when the spreading light also betrayed the surprise to a distant vessel in the east, which instantly burst into a perfect frenzy of gunfire, like a small and solitary battle.
"Jump up the masthead, Braithwaite," he said, "and tell me what you make of her."
The expected answer came floating down.
"That French brig, sir, signalling like fury, and I believe I make out a sail bearing something north of her."
It was just as he had feared. Lenoir had sent the brig northwards early in the night, and now she was reporting the presence of the surprise, if not of the China fleet, to her friends over the horizon. The long-drawn-out ruse had failed. He had meant to draw Lenoir so far to the south and west during the night that the surprise, doubling back towards the China fleet in the darkness, would be far out of sight by morning. With the frigate's great speed and how they had cracked on, he should have done it. Yet he had not. Either one of the French squadron had caught the gleam of her sails as she ran northwards through the pursuing line, or Lenoir had had an intuition that something was amiss, that he was being attempted to be made a fool of, and had called off the chase, sending the brig back to his old cruising ground, and then following her with the rest of his ships after an hour or so, crowding sail for the track of the China fleet. Yet his ruse had not failed entirely. It had gained essential time. How much time? Jack set course for the Indiamen and made his way into the cross-trees. The accursed brig lay some 4 leagues off, still carrying on like a Guy Fawkes knight, and the farther sail perhaps as much again. He would scarcely have seen her but for the purity of the horizon at this hour, which magnified the nick of her t'gallants in the line of brilliant sky. He had no doubt that she was one of the frigates, and that the whole of Linoise's squadron, less the corvette, was strung out on the likely passage of the Indiamen. They could outsail the convoy, and with this unvarying monsoon there was no avoiding them. But they could not outsail the convoy by a great deal, and it would take Lenoir the greater part of the day to concentrate his force and come up with the China fleet. The senior captains came hurrying aboard the Surprise, headed by Mr. Muffet, their commodore. The signal flying from the frigate's main truck and the commodore's energetic gathering of the stragglers had given them a general idea of the situation. They were anxious, disturbed, grave, but some, alas, were also garrulous, given to exclamation, to blaming the authorities for not protecting them, and to theories about where Lenoir had really been all this time. The company's service was a capable, disciplined body, but its regulations required the commodore to listen to the views of his captains in council before any decisive action, and like all councils of war, this was wordy, indefinite, inclined to pessimism. Jack had never so regretted the superior rigour of the Royal Navy as he did during the vague discourse of a Mr. Craig, who was concerned to show what might have been the case had they not waited for the Botany Bay ship and the 2 Portuguese.
"Gentlemen!"
cried Jack at last, addressing himself to the 3 or 4 other determined men at the table.
"This is no time for talking. There are only 2 things for it. We must either run or fight. If you run, Lenoir will snap up your fleet piecemeal, for I can stop only one of his frigates, while the Marengo can sail 5 leagues to your 3 and blow any 2 of you out of the water. If we fight, if we concentrate our force, we can answer him, gun for gun."
"Who is to fight the guns?" asked a voice.
"I will come to that, sir. What is more, Lenoir is 1 year out of a dockyard, and he is 3,000 miles from the Isle of France. He is short of stores, and single spar or 50 fathom of 2-inch rope is of 100 times more consequence to him than it is to us. I doubt there is a spare topmast in his whole squadron. In duty, he must not risk grave damage. He must not press home his attack against a determined resistance.
How do you know he is not refitted in Batavia?
We will leave that for the moment, if you please, said Jack. We have no time to lose. Here is my plan. You have three more ships than Lenoir reckoned for. The three best-armed ships will wear men-of-war pendants and the blue ensign. We are not allowed to wear Royal Navy colours. Will you give me leave to proceed, sir? That is entirely my responsibility, and I will take it upon myself to give the necessary permission. The larger Indiamen will form in line of battle, taking all available men out of the rest of the convoy to work the guns, and sending the smaller ships away to leeward. I shall send an officer aboard each ship supposed to be a man of war, and all the quarter-gunners I can spare. With a close, well-formed line, our numbers are such that we can double upon his van or rear and overwhelm him with numbers. With one or two of your fine ships on one side of him and surprise on the other, I will answer for it if we can beat the 74, let alone the frigates.
"Hear him! Hear him!" cried Mr. Muffet, taking Jack by the hand. "That's the spirit! God's my life!"
In the confusion of voices, it became clear that although there was eager and indeed enthusiastic support, one captain even beating the table and roaring,
"We'll thump 'em again and again!"
there were others who were not of the same opinion. Who had ever heard of merchant ships with encumbered decks and few hands holding out for 5 minutes against powerful men of war? Most of them had only miserable 18-pounder cannonades. A far, far better plan was to separate. Some would surely escape. The Dorsetshire was certain she could outrun the French. Could the gentleman give any example of a ship with a 270-pound broadside resisting an enemy that could throw 950 pounds?
"Whisht, Mr. Craig," said Muffet before Jack could reply. "Do you not know Captain Aubrey is the gentleman who commanded the Sophie brig when she took the Cacafuego, a 32-gun frigate? And I believe, sir, Sophie threw no great broadside."
28 pounds, said Jack, reddening.
"Why?" cried Craig. "I spoke only out of my duty to the company. I honour the gentleman, I'm sure, and I'm sorry I did not just recollect his name. He will not find me shy, I believe. I spoke only for the company and my cargo, not for myself."
"I believe, gentlemen," said Muffet, "that the sense of the council is in favour of Captain Aubrey's plan, as I am myself. I hear no dissentient voice. Gentlemen, I desire you will repair aboard your ships, fill powder, clear away your guns, and attend to Captain Aubrey's signals."
Aboard the Surprise, Jack called his officers to the cabin and said,
"Mr. Pullings, you will proceed to the Lushington Indiaman with Collins, Haverhill, and Polyblank. Mr. Babington to Royal George with the brothers Moss. Mr. Braithwaite, to the brig to repeat signals. Take the spare set with you. Mr. Bowes, can I persuade you to look to the Earl Camden's guns? I know you can point them better than any of us."
The purser flushed bright with pleasure and chuckled. If the captain wished, he would certainly abandon his cheese and candles, though he did not know how he should like it, and he begged for Evans and Strawberry Joe.
"That is settled then," said Jack. "Now, gentlemen, this is a delicate business. We must not offend the company's officers, and some of them are very touchy. The least sense of ill-feeling would be disastrous. The men must be made to understand that thoroughly. No pride, no distance, no reference to tea-wagons or how we do things in the Navy. Our one aim must be to keep their guns firing briskly, to engage Lenoir closely, and to wound his spars and rigging as much as ever we can. Hulling him or killing his people is beside the point. He would give his bosun for a stunsail boom, and with the best will in the world we shall never sink a 74. We must fire like Frenchmen for once. Mr. Stoughton, you and I will work out a list of the gunners we can spare, and while I am sharing them among the Indiamen, you will take the ship to the eastward and watch Lenoir's motions."
Within an hour the line had formed. 15 handsome Indiamen under easy sail a cable's length apart, and a fast-sailing brig to repeat signals. Boats plied to and from the smaller ships, bringing volunteers for the guns. And all that forenoon Jack hurried up and down the line in his barge, dispensing officers, gunners, discreet advice and encouragement, and stores of affability. This affability was rarely forced, for most of the captains were right seamen, and given their fiery commodore's strong lead, they set to with a determination that made Jack love them. Decks were clearing fast. The three ships chosen for pendants, the Lushington, the Royal George, and the Earl Camden, began to look even more like men of war, with whitewashers over their sides disguising them fast, and royal yards crossed, and the guns ran in and out without a pause. Yet there were some awkward captains, lukewarm, despondent, and reserved, two of them timid old fools, and the passengers were the cruelest trial. Atkins and the other members of Mr. Stanhope's suite could be dealt with, but the women and the important civilians called for personal interviews and for explanations. One lady, darting from an unlikely hatch, told him she should countenance no violence whatsoever. Lenoir should be reasoned with. His passions would certainly yield to reason, and Jack was kept very busy. It was only from time to time, as he sat in the barge next church, his solemn aide-de-camp, that he had leisure to ponder the remark, "How do you know he is not refitted in Batavia?" He did not know it. Yet his whole strategy must be based upon that assumption. He did not know it, but still he was willing to risk everything upon his intuitions being sound. For it was a matter of intuition. Lenoir's cautious handling of his ship, a thousand details that Jack could hardly name, but that contrasted strongly with the carefree Lenoir of the Mediterranean, with Toulon and its naval stores a few days' sail away. Yet moral certainty could fade. He was not infallible, and Lenoir was old in war, a resourceful, dangerous opponent. Dinner aboard the Lushington with Captain Muffet was a relief. Not only was Jack desperately sharp-set, having missed his breakfast, but Muffet was a man after his own heart. They saw eye to eye on the formation of the line, the way to conduct the action, aggressive tactics rather than defence, and on the right dinner to restore a worn and badgered spirit. Church appeared while they were drinking coffee. "A surprise signalling, sir, if you please," he said. "Semillon, Marengo, and Belle Poule, bearing east by south about 4 leagues. Marengo has backed topsails."
"He is waiting for Berceau to come up," said Jack. "We shall not see him for an hour or two. What do you say, sir, to a turn on deck?"
Left alone, the midshipman silently devoured the remains of the pudding, pocketed 2 French rolls, and darted after his captain, who was standing with the commodore on the poop, watching the last boats pull away from the line, filled with passengers bound for the hypothetical safety of the leeward division.
"I cannot tell you, sir," said Muffet, in a low voice, "what a feeling of peace it gives me to see them go. Deep, abiding peace. You gentlemen have your admirals and commissioners, no doubt, and indeed the enemy to bring your spirits low. But passengers! Captain, there are mice in this ship. They have ate my bonnet and 2 pairs of gloves. I shall complain to the directors. My cousin is a director, sir. Captain, why cannot I get a soft-boiled egg in this ship? I told the young man at India House my child could not possibly be expected to digest a hard yolk. Captain, there are no cupboards, no drawers in my cabin, nowhere to hang anything. No room, no room, no room. Do you hear me, sir? There will be all the room you merit where you are going to. 10 brimstone shrews packing into 1 cabin in a country ship. How I love to see 'em go! The distance cannot be too great for me."
"Let us increase it, then. Give them leave to part company. Throw out the signal to tack in succession again, and there you have 2 birds in 1 bush. It is a poor heart that never rejoices."
The flags ran up, the ships to leeward acknowledged and made sail, and the line prepared to go about. First the Alfred, then the Coutts, then the Wexford, and now the Lushington. As she approached the troubled wake where the Wexford had begun her turn, Mr. Muffet took over from his chief mate and put her about himself, smooth, steady, and exact. The Lushington swung through 90 degrees, and the Surprise came into view on her port bow. The sight of her low, checkered hull and her towering masts lifted Jack's heart, and his grave face broke into a loving smile. But after this second's indulgence, his eyes searched beyond her, and there, clear on the horizon, were the t'gansels of Lenoir's squadron. The Lushington steadied on her course. Mr. Muffet stepped back from the rail, mopping his face, for the turn had brought the sun full onto the poop, where the awning had long since been replaced by splinter netting, which gave no protection from the fiery beams. He hurried to the side and stood watching the centre and the rear. The line was reformed, heading southeast, with the larboard tacks aboard, a line of ships 1.5 miles long lying between the enemy and the rest of the convoy, a line of concentrated fire, nowhere strong, but moderately formidable from its quantity and from the mutual support of the close order. A trim line, too. The Ganges and the Bombay Castle were sagging away a little to leeward, but their intervals were correct. The East India captains could handle their ships, of that there was no doubt. They had performed this manoeuvre 3 times already, and never had there been a blunder nor even a hesitation. Slow, of course, compared with the Navy, but uncommon sure. They could handle their ships. Could they fight them, too? That was the question.
"I admire the regularity of your line, sir," said Jack. "The Channel Fleet could not keep station better."
"I am happy to hear you say so," said Muffet. "We may not have your heavy crews, but we do try to do things seamanlike.
Though between you and me and the binnacle, he added in a personal aside, I dare say the presence of your people may have something to do with it. There is not one of us would not sooner lose an eye tooth than miss stays with a king's officer looking on.
That reminds me, said Jack. Should you dislike wearing the king's coat for the occasion, you and the gentlemen who are to have pendants? Lenoir is devilish sly, and if his spyglass picks up the company's uniform in ships that are supposed to be men of war, he will smoke what we are about. It might encourage him to make a bolder stroke than we should care for.
It was a wounding suggestion. It was not happily expressed. Muffet felt it keenly. He weighed the possible advantage, the extreme gravity of the situation, and after a moment he said he should be honoured. Most happy.
Then let us recall the frigate, and I will send across all the coats we possess.
The Surprise came running down the wind, rounded to outside the line, and lay there with her for topsail to the mast, looking as easy and elegant as a thoroughbred.
Goodbye, Captain Muffet, said Jack, shaking his hand. I do not suppose we shall see one another again before the old gentleman is with us, but we are of one mind, I am sure, and you must allow me to add that I am very happy to have such a colleague.
Sir, said Captain Muffet, with an iron grasp, you do me altogether too much honour.
The lively pleasure of being aboard his own ship again, her quick life and response after the heavy deliberation of the Indiaman, her uncluttered decks, a clean sweep fore and aft, the perfect familiarity of everything about her, including the remote sound of Stephen's cello somewhere below, improvising on a theme Jack knew well but could not name. The frigate moved up to the head of the line, and on his strangely thin quarter-deck, only the more vapid youngsters left and the master, apart from Etheridge and Starton, he listened to his first lieutenant's report of Linoise's motions. The report confirmed his own impressions. The admiral had gathered his force, and his apparent delay was in fact an attempt at gaining the weather gauge and at making sure of what he was about before committing himself.
"I dare say he will put about as soon as ever he fetches our wake," he observed, "and then he will move faster. But even so, I doubt he will be up with us much before sunset."
He gave directions for making free with all the officers' coats aboard, and walked over to the taffrail, where Mr. White was standing alone, disconsolate and wan.
"I believe, sir, this is your first taste of warfare," he said. "I'm afraid you must find it pretty wearisome with no cabin and no proper meals."
"Oh, I do not mind that in the least, sir," cried the chaplain, "but I must confess that in my ignorance I had expected something more, shall I say, exciting. These slow, remote manoeuvres, this prolonged, anxious anticipation formed no part of my image of a battle. Drums and trumpets, banners, stirring exhortations, martial cries, a plunging into the thick of the fray, the shouting of captains. This, rather than interminable waiting in discomfort, in suspended animation, had been my uninformed idea. You will not misunderstand me if I say, I wonder you can stand the boredom."
"It is use, no doubt. War is nine parts boredom, and we grow used to it in the service. But the last hour makes up for all, believe me. I think you may be assured of some excitement tomorrow, or perhaps even this evening. No trumpets, I am afraid, nor exhortations, but I shall do my best in the shouting line, and I dare say you will find the guns dispel the tedium. You will like that, I am sure. It raises a man's spirits amazingly."
"Your remark is no doubt very just, and it reminds me of my duty. Would not a spiritual as well as a physical preparation be proper?"
"Why," said Jack, considering, "we shall all be most grateful, I am sure, for a te deum when the business is done, but at this moment I fear it is not possible to rig church."
He had served under blue light captains, and he had gone into bloody action with psalms drifting in the wake, but he disliked it extremely.
"But if it were possible," he went on, "and if I may say so without levity, I should pray for a swell, a really heavy swell. Mr. Church, signal, tack in succession, all hands about ship."
He mounted the hammock netting to watch the brig that lay outside the line, where all the long file could see her. A great deal would depend on Braithwaite's promptness in repeating signals. The hoist ran up, the signal gun fired to windward.
"I shall give them a moment to brood over it," he said inwardly,
paused until he saw the scurrying stop on the forecastle of the Alfred, just astern, and then cried,
"Ready, O, helms alee!"
This movement brought the Indiamen to the point where the Surprise had turned. While the Surprise, on the opposite tack, passed each in succession, the whole line describing a sharp follow-my-leader curve. And as they passed, he stared at each with the most concentrated attention. The Alfred, the Coots, each with one of his quartermasters aboard. In her zeal, the Coots ran her bowsprit over the Alfred's taffrail, but they fell apart with no more damage than hard words and a shrill piping in the Lascar tongue.
The Wexford, a handsome ship in capital order. She could give the rest her main topsail and still keep her station. A fine, eager captain who had fought his way out of a cloud of Borneo pirates last year. Now the Lushington, with Pullings standing next to Mr. Muffet on the quarterdeck. He could see his grin from here. And there were several other Royal Navy coats aboard her. Ganges, Exeter, and Abergavenny. She still had water butts on her deck. What was a captain thinking of? Glogue, a weak man, and old.
God, he thought, never let me outlive my wits.
Now a gap in the centre for the surprise. Addington, a flash, nasty ship. Bombay Castle, somewhat to leeward. Her bosun and Old Reliable were still at work on the breechings of her guns. Camden, and there was Bowes limping aft as fast as he could go to move his hat as the surprise went by. It never made a man so happy as when he entrusted Camden's guns to the purser. Yet Bowes was not a bloody-minded man at all. Cumberland, a heavy, unweatherly lump, crowding sail to keep station. Hope, with another dismal old brute in command. Lukewarm, punctilious. Royal George, and she was a beauty. You would have sworn she was a post-ship. His second-best coat stood there on the quarter-deck, its epaulette shining in the sun. Rather large for her captain, but he would do it no discredit. The best of them all, after Muffet. He and Babington were laughing side by side abaft the davits. Dorset, with more European seamen than usual, but only a miserable tier of pop-guns. Ocean, a doubtful quantity.
"Sir," said Stoughton, "Linois putting about, if you please."
"So he is," said Jack, glancing aft. "He has fetched our wake at last. It is time to take our station. Mr. Church, signal, reduce sail. Mr. Harrowby, be so good as to place the ship between Addington and Abergavenny."
Up until the present, Lenoir had been continually manoeuvring to gain the wind, and to gather his forces, making short tacks, standing now towards the Indiamen, now from them. But he had formed his line at last, and this movement was one of direct pursuit. While the surprise lay to, he turned his glass to the French squadron. Not that there was any need for a telescope to see their positions, for they were all hull up. It was the detail of their trim that would tell him what was going on in Lenoir's mind. What he saw gave him no comfort. The French ships were crowding sail as though they had not a care in the world. In the van, the Semillante was already throwing a fine bow wave. Close behind, Marengo was setting her royals, and although the Belle Poule lay quarter of a mile astern, she was drawing up. Then there was the Berceau. How she managed to spread so much canvas after the drubbing she had received, he could not conceive. An astonishing feat. Very fine seamen aboard the Berceau. In the present position, with the Indiamen under easy sail on the starboard tack, with the wind 2 points free and Lenoir 5 miles away, coming after them from the eastwards on the same tack, Jack could delay the action by hauling his wind, delay it until the morning, unless Lenoir chose to risk a night action. There was a good deal to be said for delay. Rest, food, greater preparation, and their sailing order was not what he could have wished. But on the other hand, a bold front was the very essence of the thing. Lenoir must be made to believe that the China fleet had an escort, not a powerful escort perhaps, but strong enough to inflict serious damage with the help of the armed Indiamen if he pushed home his attack. As for the sailing order, there would be too much risk of confusion if he changed it now. They were not used to these manoeuvres. And in any case, once the melee began, once the smoke, din, and confusion of close action did away with the rigid discipline of the line and with communication, those captains who really meant to lay their ships alongside an enemy would do so. The others would not. The tactics that he had agreed upon with Muffet and that had been explained to the captains were those of close, enveloping action. The line of battle to be maintained until the last moment, and then to double upon the French ships, to take them between two or even three broadsides, overwhelming them with numbers, however weak the fire of each company's ship. If a regular doubling was not possible, then each captain was to use his judgment to bring about the same position, a cluster of ships round every Frenchman, cutting up his sails and rigging at the closest range. Now, after hours of reflection, he still thought this idea the best. Close range was essential to make the indifferent guns bite hard, and if he were Lenoir, he should very much dislike being surrounded, hampered, and battered by a determined swarm, above all if some men of war were mingled with the Indiamen. His greatest dread, after the doubtful fighting qualities of the merchantmen, was that of a distant cannonade, with the heavy, well-pointed French guns hitting his ships from 1,000 yards. Lenoir vanished behind the foresail of the Addington as the surprise glided into her place in the centre of the line. Jack looked up at the masthead and felt a sudden overwhelming weariness. His mind was running clear and sharp, and the continual variation of the opposed forces presented itself as a hard, distinct point on a graph. But his arms and legs were drained of strength.
"By God," he thought, "I'm growing old. Yesterday's brush and talking to all these people has knocked me up. But at least Lenoir is still older. If he comes on, maybe he will make a blunder. God send he makes a blunder. Bondon," he cried, "run up to the masthead and tell me how they bear."
They bore 3 points on the quarter, 2.5 points on the quarter. Belpool had set her forestaysail, and she had closed with a two-decker. They were coming up hand over fist. The hails followed one another at steady intervals, and all the time the sun sank in the west. When at last Bondon reported the Semillant at extreme random shot of the rear of the line, Jack said to the signal midshipman,
"Mr. Lee, edge away 1 point, and get the next hoists ready. Prepare to wear all together at the gun. Course southeast by east. Van engage to windward on coming up, centre and rear to leeward."
This was the aggressive manoeuvre of a commander eager to bring on decisive action. Waring would reverse the order of sailing and send the whole line fast and straight for the French squadron close-hauled on the opposite tack, a line that would divide on coming up and threaten to take them between two fires. It would throw away the advantage of the wind, but he dared not tack altogether. Too dangerous an evolution by far in close order, and even this simultaneous wearing was dangerous enough, although a few minutes of edging away would make it safer. Indeed, Lenoir might well take it as a mark of confidence. Now they had edged away from the wind. The line was slanting farther south, with the wind just before the beam.
"Carry on, Mr. Lee,"
he said, and turned to watch the repeating brig. The signals ran up aboard her, brisk and clear.
"I must give the Indiamen time to make them out," he said, deliberately pacing to and fro.
The slow match for the signal gun sent its acrid smoke across the deck, and he found his breath coming short. Everything depended on this manoeuvre being carried out correctly. If they turned into a disordered heap, if there was irresolution, Lenoir would smoke his game, and in 5 minutes he would be among them, firing both sides with his 36 and 24-pounders. Another turn. Another.
"Fire!" he said. "All hands wear ship!"
Up and down the line of orders echoed. The bosun's pipes shrilled out. The ships began their turn, bringing the wind aft, right astern on the larboard quarter, onto the beam and beyond, the yards coming round, round, and harder round, until the whole line, with scarcely an irregularity, was close-hauled on the larboard tack, each having turned in its place, so that now the Ocean led and the Alfred brought up the rear. A beautifully executed evolution, almost faultless.
"Mr. Lee, make more sail, hoist colours!"
Blue, because Admiral Hervey in Bombay was a vice-admiral of the blue. The Surprise, being under Admiralty orders, wore the white. Handsome colours, and imposing, but the speed of the line did not increase.
"Signal! Ocean, make more sail! Repeat, Ocean, make more sail!" cried Jack. "And give him 2 guns!"
Ahead of them now, and broad on the larboard bow, there was the French squadron in a rigid line, colours flying, the Admiral's flag at the mizzen. The two lines were drawing together at a combined speed of 14 knots. In less than 5 minutes they would be within range. Jack ran forward, and as he reached the forecastle, Lenoir fired a gun. But a blank gun, a signal gun, and its smoke had hardly cleared before the French ships hauled their wind, heading north-northwest, and declining the engagement. Back on his quarterdeck, Jack signalled, "Tack in succession," and the line came about, stretching towards the setting sun. In the depths, the cello was still singing away, deep and meditative, and all at once the elusive name came to him. It was the Boccherini Suite in D minor. He smiled, a great smile, filled with many kinds of happiness.
"Well, gentlemen," he said, "that was pretty creditable in the Indiamen, hey, hey?"
"I should scarcely have believed it, sir," said Starton. "Not a single ship fell foul of another. It was giving them time to edge away that did it, no doubt."
"Lenoir did not care for it," said Etheridge, "but until the very last moment I did not think he would sheer off, night action or no night action."
Harraby said, "The company officers are a well-behaved set of men. Many of them are serious." Jack laughed aloud. Out of piety or superstition, he would not even formulate the thought,
"He mistook the situation, he has made his blunder,"
far less put it into words. He touched a belaying pin and said,
"He will spend the night plying to windward while we lie to. His people will be worn out for the morning action. Ours must get all the rest we can manage, and food.
Mr. Starton, since we have lost our purser, I must ask you to see to the serving out of the provisions. Let the men make a good hearty supper. There are some hams in my storeroom. Where is my steward? Pass the word for—
Here I am, sir, and have been a-standing by the bits this half-glass and more, said Killick, in his disagreeable injured whine, a-holding of this sanguich and this here mug of wine.
The Burgundy went down more gratefully than any wine he had ever drunk, strengthening his heart, dispelling weariness.
"So there is to be no battle after all," said the chaplain, moving from the shadows and addressing either Etheridge or the master. "They appear to be slanting off at a great pace. Can it be timidity? I have often heard that the French are great cowards."
"No, no, don't you believe in Mr. White," said Jack. "They have tanned my hide many a time, I can tell you. No, no, Lenoir is only reculing pour mieux sauter, as he would say. You shall not be disappointed. I believe we may promise you a brisk cannonade in the morning, so perhaps you might be well advised to turn in directly and get all the sleep you can. I shall do the same, once I have seen the captains."
All that night they lay to, with stern lanterns and top-lights right along the line, each watch in turn at quarters, and 50 night-glasses trained on Admiral Linoise's lights as he worked up to windward. In the middle watch Jack woke for a few minutes to find the ship pitching heavily. His prayer had been answered, and a heavy swell was setting in from the south. He need not dread the Frenchman's distant fire. Accuracy, long range, and a calm sea were birds tarred with the same feather. Dawn broke calm, sweet, and clear over the troubled sea, and it showed the French and British lines 3 miles apart. Lenoir had, of course, spent all the night in beating up, so that now he had the weather gauge without any sort of a doubt. Now he could bring on the action whenever he chose. He had the power, but did not seem inclined to use it. His squadron backed and filled, rolling and pitching on the swell. After some time the Semillante left her station, came down to reconnoitre within gunshot, and returned. Still the French hung aloof, lying there on the beam of the English line, with their heads northwest, and the heat of the day increased. The swell from some distant southern tempest ran across the unvarying northeast monsoon, and every few minutes the sharp, choppy seas sent an agreeable spray flying over the Surprise's quarterdeck.
"If we engage her from the leeward," observed Jack, with his eyes fixed on the Marengo, "she will find it damned uncomfortable to open her lower ports."
She carried her lower guns high, like most French line-of-battleships, but even so, with her side pressed down by this fine breeze and with such a sea running, her lower deck would be flooded. All the more so in that she was somewhat crank, somewhat inclined to lie over, no doubt from want of stores deep in her hold. If Lenoir could not use his lower tier, his heaviest guns, the match would be more nearly even. Was that the reason why he was lying there, backing and filling, when he was master of the situation, with a convoy worth 6 millions under his lee? What was in his mind? Plain hesitation. Had he been painfully impressed by the sight of the British line lying to all night, a long string of lights inviting action in the morning instead of silently dispersing in the darkness, which they would surely have done if yesterday's bold advance had been a ruse?
"Pipe the hands to breakfast," he said. "And Mr. Church, be so good as to let Killick know that if my coffee is not on deck in 15 seconds, he will be crucified at noon. Doctor, a very good morning to you. Ain't it a pure day? Here is the coffee at last. Will you take a cup? Did you sleep? Ha! What a capital thing it is to sleep."
He had had 5 hours in his wool-lined well, and now new, vigorous life flowed through him. He knew he was committed to an extremely dangerous undertaking, but he also knew that he should either succeed or that he should fail creditably. It would be a near-run thing in either event, but he had not launched himself, his ship, and 1,500 other men into a foolhardy enterprise. The anxiety was gone. One of the reasons for this was the new feeling right along the line of battle. The captains had handled their ships well, and they knew it. The success of their manoeuvre and Lenoir's retreat had done wonders for the fighting spirit of those who had been somewhat backward, and now there was a unanimity, a readiness to fall in with a plan of attack that delighted him. However, he knew how early morning sprightliness could anger his friend, and he contented himself with walking up and down, balancing his coffee cup against the heavy motion of a ship hove to, and champing a ship's biscuit dipped in ghee. Breakfast was over, and still the French squadron made no move.
"We must help him to make up his mind," said Jack.
The signals ran up. The British line filled on the starboard tack and stood away to the westward under topsails and courses alone. At once the frigate's motion became easier, a smooth, even glide, and at once the French ships in the distance wore round on the opposite tack, slanting down southwards for the Indiaman.
"At last," said Jack. "Now just what will he do?"
When he had watched them long enough to be sure that this was not an idle move, but the certain beginning from which all things must follow, he said,
"Stephen, it is time for you to go below. Mr. Starton, beat to quarters."
The drum, more stirring even than a trumpet, volleyed and thundered, but there was nothing to be done. The Surprise had long been stripped for battle, her yards puddened and slung with chains, splinter netting rigged, powder filled and waiting, shot of all kinds at hand, match smoking in little tubs along the deck. The men ran to their stations and stood or knelt there, gazing out over their guns at the enemy. The French were coming down under easy sail, the Marengo leading. It was not clear what they meant to do, but the general opinion among the older seamen was that they would presently wear round onto the same tack as the Indiamen, steer a parallel course, and engage the centre and van in the usual way, using their greater speed to pass along it, whereas others thought Lenoir might cross their wake and haul up to engage from leeward so that he could use his lower guns, now shut up tight behind their port lids, with green water dashing against them. At all events, they and all the frigate's company were convinced that the time of slow manoeuvring was over, that in a quarter of an hour the dust would begin to fly, and there was silence throughout the ship. A grave silence, not without anxiety, and an urgent longing for it to start. Jack was too much taken up with watching his line and with interpreting Lenoir's movements to feel much of this brooding impatience. But he too was eager for the moment of grappling and of certainty, for he knew very well that he was faced with a formidable opponent, capable of daring, unusual tactics. Lenoir's next move took him by surprise, however. The Admiral, judging that the head of the long British line was sufficiently advanced for his purposes, and knowing that the Indiamen could neither tack nor sail at any great speed, suddenly crowded sail. It was a well-concerted manoeuvre. Every French ship and even the brig blossomed out in a great spread of white canvas. Royals appeared, stunsails stretched out like wings, doubling the breadth of the ships and giving them a great and menacing beauty as they ran down upon the merchantmen. For a moment he could understand neither their course nor their evolution, but then it came to him with instant conviction.
"By God," he said, "he means to break the line. Lee, tack in succession, make all practicable sail."
As the signal broke out, it became even more certain that this was so. Lenoir was setting his heavy ship straight at the gap between the Hope and the Cumberland, two of the weakest ships. He meant to pass through the line, cut off the rear, leave a ship or two to deal with what his fire had left, luff up and range along the lee of the line, firing his full broadside. Jack snatched Starton's speaking trumpet, sprang to the taffrail, and hailed his next astern with all his force.
"Haddington! Back your topsail! I am tacking out of the line!"
Turning, he cried,
"All hands about ship! Hard over! Harrowby, lay me athwart the Marengo's hawse!"
Now the long, hard training told. The frigate turned in a tight, smooth curve with never a check, moving faster and faster as they packed on sail after sail. She tore through the water with her lee chains deep in white foam, heading close-hauled for the point where her course would cut the Marengo's, somewhere short of the British line if this speed could be maintained. He must take her down and hold the Marengo until the van ships could follow him, could reach him and give the Surprise their support. With her speed it was possible, so long as he lost no important spars. To be sure, it meant running straight into Marengo's broadside, yet it might be done, particularly in such a sea. But if he did it, if he was not dismasted, how long could he hold her? How long would it take for the van to reach him? He dared not disrupt the line. The merchantmen's safety depended entirely on its strength and unity, and the mutual support of its combined fire in close order. Poised at the break of the quarterdeck, he checked the position once more. The Surprise had already passed three ships, the Addington, Bombay Castle, and Camden, moving up in the opposite direction towards their turning point, and they were making sail. The gap had closed. On the port bow, a long mile away to the northeast, the Marengo, with white water breaking against her bows. On the port quarter, still a mile away, the Alfred and the Coots had made their turn, and they were setting to gansels. The Wexford was in stays, and it looked as though the eager Lushington might fall foul of her. He nodded. It could be done. Indeed, there was no choice. He jumped down the ladder and hurried along the gun crews, and he spoke to them with a particular friendliness, a kind of intimacy. They were old shipmates now. He knew each man, and he liked the greater part of them. They were to be sure not to waste a shot,
To fire high for this spell on the upward roll, ball and then chain as soon as it would fetch. The ship might get a bit of a drubbing as they ran down, but they were not to mind it. The Frenchman could not open his lower ports, and they should serve him out once they got snug athwart his bows. He knew they would fire steady. Let them watch Old Reliable. He'd never wasted a shot all this commission, and they were to mind their priming. Old Reliable winked his only eye and gave a chuckle. The first ranging shot from the Marengo plunged into the sea 100 yards out on the larboard beam, sending up a tall white plume torn away by the wind. Another closer, and to starboard. A pause, and now the Marengo's side disappeared behind a white cloud of smoke spreading from her bows to her quarter. 4 shots of the thundering broadside struck home, 3 hitting the frigate's bows and 1 her cathead. He looked at his watch, told his clerk to note down the time and kept it in his hand as he paced up and down with Starton at his side until the next great rippling crash. Far more accurate. White water leapt all round her, topmast high. So many 24-pound shots struck home that her hull rang again. Way was momentarily checked. She staggered. Holes appeared in her fore and mainsails, and a clutter of blocks fell onto the splinter netting above the waist.
"Just under 2 minutes," he observed. "Indifferent brisk?"
The surprise took no more than 1 minute 20 seconds between broadsides.
"But thank God her lower ports are shut."
Before Marengo fired the next, the frigate would be 1/4 mile nearer. The Semillante, Marengo's next astern, opened fire with her forward guns. He saw one ball travelling from him, racing astern as he reached the taffrail in his ritual to and fro, a distinct ball with a kind of slight halo about it.
"Mr. Starton, the bow gun may fire?"
It would do no harm. It might do good, even at this range, and the din would relieve the silent men. The 2 minutes were gone. Some seconds passed, and the Marengo's careful, deliberate broadside came, hitting the surprise like a hammer, barely a shot astray, and immediately after that 6 guns from the Semillante, all high and wide. Starton reported,
"Spritsail yard gone in the sling, sir. The carpenter finds 3 foot in the well. He is plugging a couple of holes under the waterline, not very low."
As he spoke, the bow gun roared out and the encouraging, heady smell of powder smoke came aft.
"Warm work, Mr. Starton," said Jack, smiling. "But at least Semillante cannot reach us again. The angle is too narrow. When Marengo starts firing grape, let the men lie down at their guns."
Fine on the port bow, he could see the last of the Marengo's guns running out. They were waiting for the roll. He glanced round his sparse quarterdeck before he turned in his walk. Bondon and Carlo at the wheel, Harrowby behind them conning the ship. Starton calling out an order at the hanses. Sail trimmers to the topsail bowline. Over to leeward, the signal midshipman, then Callow with his bandaged head to run messages, and young Nevin, the clerk, with his slate in his hand. Etheridge watching the Indiamen through his little pocket glass. All the marines, apart from the sentry at the hatchway, were scattered among the gun crews. The crash of the broadside and of the bow gun, and of the 20 shot hitting her, came in one breath, an extreme violence of noise. He saw the wheel disintegrate, Harrowby jerked backwards to the taffrail, cut in two. And forward there was a screaming. Instantly he bent to the speaking tube that led below, to the men posted at the relieving tackles that could take over from the wheel.
"Below there! Does she steer?"
"Yes, sir."
"Thus, very well, thus. Keep her dice, d'ye hear me?"
3 guns had been dismounted, and splinters, bits of carriage, bits of rail, booms, shattered boats littered the decks as far aft as the mainmast, together with scores of hammocks torn from their netting. The jib boom lurched from side to side, its cap shot through. Cannonballs, scattered from their racks and garlands, rumbled about the heaving deck. But far more dangerous were the loose guns running free. Concentrated, lethal weight gone mad, he plunged into the disorder forward. Few officers, little coordination, catching up a bloody hammock as he ran. 2 tons of metal, once the cherished larboard chaser, poised motionless on the top of the roll, ready to rush back across the deck and smash its way through the starboard side. He clapped the hammock under it and whipped a line round the swell of its muzzle, calling for men to make it fast to a stanchion. And as he called, a loose 36-pound shot ran crack against his ankle, bringing him down. Starton was at the next, a carronade still in its carriage, trying to hold it with a handspike as it threatened to plunge down the fore hatchway and thence through the frigate's bottom. The combings round the hole yielded like cardboard. Then the forward pitch took off the strain. The gun rolled towards the bows, and as it gathered speed, they tripped it, throwing it over onto its side. But the same pitch, the same shift of slope, working upon the loose gun amidships under the gangway, sent it faster and faster through the confused group of men, each with his own notion of how to stop it, so that it ran full tilt against the side abaft the forechains, smashed through and plunged into the sea. Oh, for his officers! High discipline did away with the men's initiative, but those he had left were hard at their duty. Rattray out on the perilous bowsprit already with two of his mates, gammoning the jib-boom before it carried away. Etheridge with half a dozen marines tossing the balls over the side or securing them. Callow and his boat's crew heaving the wreckage of the launch free of the guns. He darted a look at the Marengo. All but two of her guns were run out again.
"Lie flat!"
he roared, and for the space of the rising wave there was silence all along the deck, broken only by the wind, the racing water, and an odd ball grumbling down the gangway. The full broadside and the howl of grape tearing over the deck, but too high, a little hurried. Rattray and his mates were still there, working with concentrated fury and bawling for 10 fathom of 2-inch rope and more handspikes. The Surprise was still on her headlong course, her way only slightly checked by the loss of her outer jib and the riddling of her sails, and now the rear Indiamen opened fire from half a mile. There were holes in the Marengo's for topsails, and he doubted she would get in another broadside before the Surprise was so close on her bow that the broadside guns would no longer bear, could not be trained far enough forward to reach her. If the Marengo yawed off her course to bring the Surprise into her fire, then Linoise's plan was defeated. At this speed, a yaw would carry the two-decker east of the unbroken line. He limped back to the quarter-deck, where young Nevin was on his hands and knees, being sick.
"All's well, Bondon?"
he asked, kneeling to the tube.
"Below there! Ease a half a point! Another half! Belay!"
She was steering heavy now.
"Prime, sir," said Bondon. "Just my left arm sprung. Carlo copped it."
"Give me a hand with t'other, then,"
said Jack, and they slid Harrowby over the taffrail. Away astern, beyond the splash of the body, 6 of the Indiamen were already round. They were coming down under a fine press of sail, but they were still a long way off. Wide on the port bow, the Marengo was almost within his reach at last.
"Stand to your guns!" he cried. "Hard for it! Do not waste a shot! Wait for it! Wait for it!"
5 foot, water in the well, sir," said Starton.
Jack nodded.
"Half a point!"
he called down the pipe again, and again the ghostly voice answered,
"Half a point it is, sir!"
Heavy she might be. Heavy she was. But unless she foundered, in the next minute he would hit the Marengo, hit her very, very hard, for as the Surprise came closer to crossing the Marengo's bows, so her silent broadside would come into play at last, and at close range. Musketry crackling on the Marengo's forecastle, her marines packed into her bows and foretop, another 100 yards, and unless Marengo yawed he would rake her, and if she did yaw, then there they would lie, broadside to broadside, and fight it out.
"Mr. Starton, some hands to clue up and to back the foretopsail. Callow, Lee, Church, jump along forward."
Closer, closer. The Marengo was still coming along with a splendid bow wave. The Surprise was moving slower. She would cross the Marengo at something under 200 yards, and already she was so near the two-decker that the Indiamen had stopped firing from fear of hitting her. Still closer, for the full force of the blow. The crews crouched tense over their pointed guns, shifting them a trifle for the aim with a total concentration indifferent to the musket balls.
"Fire!"
he said as the upward roll began. The guns went off in a long roar. The smoke cleared, and there was the Marengo's head and forecastle swept clean, ropes dangling, a staysail flying wild.
"Too low!" he cried. "Pitch 'em up! Pitch 'em up! Callow, Church, pitch 'em up!"
There was no point in merely killing Frenchmen. It was rigging, spars, masts that counted, not the blood that now ran from the Marengo's bow scuppers, crimson against her streak of white. The grunting, furious work of running in, swabbing, loading, ramming, running out, and number 3, the fastest gun, fired first.
"Clue up!"
he shouted above the thunder.
"Back for topsail!"
The Surprise slowed, lost her way, and lay, shrouded in her own smoke, right athwart the Marengo's bows, hammering her as fast as ever the guns could fire. The 3rd broadside merged into the 4th. The firing was continuous now, and Starton and the midshipmen ran up and down the line, pointing, heaving, translating their captain's hoarse barks into directed fire, a tempest of chain. After their drubbing, the men were a little out of hand, and now they could serve the Frenchmen out. Their fire was somewhat wild and often too low, but at this range not a shot flew wide. The powder boys ran, the cartridges came up in a racing stream, the gun crews cheered like maniacs, stripped to the waist, pouring with sweat, taking their sweet revenge, thumping it into her, cramming their guns to the muzzle. But it was too good to last. Through the smoke it was clear that Lenoir meant to run the Surprise aboard, run the small frigate bodily down or board her.
"Drop the forecourse! Fill the foretopsail!"
he cried with the full force of his lungs, and down the tube,
"2 points off!"
He must at all costs keep on the Marengo's bows and keep hitting her. She was a slaughterhouse forward, but nothing vital had yet carried away. The surprise forged on in a sluggish, heavy turn, and the two deckers' side came into view. They were opening their lower ports, running out the great 36-pounders in spite of the sea. One shift of her helm to bring them to bear, and the surprise would have the whole shattering broadside within pistol shot. Then they could clap the lower ports too, for she would be sunk. Etheridge, with four muskets and his servant to load them, was firing steadily at the Marengo's foretop, picking off any man who showed. Half a mile astern, the British van opened fire on the Semillant and Belle Poole, who had been reaching them this last 5 minutes. Smoke everywhere, and the thunder of the broadsides deadened the breeze.
"Port! Port! Hard a port!"
he called down the tube, and straightening,
"Main course there!"
Where was her speed, poor dear surprise? She could just keep ahead of the Marengo, but only by falling away from the wind so far that her guns could not bear, and her stern was pointing at the Marengo's bows. Fire slackened, died away, and the men stared aft at the Marengo. Two spokes of her wheel would bring the Frenchman's broadside round. Already they could see the double line of muzzles projecting from their ports. Why did she not yaw? Why was she signalling? A great bellowing of guns to starboard told them why. The Royal George, followed by the two ships astern of her, had left the line, the holy line, and they were coming up fast to engage the Marengo on the other side, while the van was closing in from the west, threatening to envelop him, the one manoeuvre that Lenoir dreaded. The Marengo hauled her wind, and her swing brought the frigate's guns into play again. They blazed out, and the two-decker instantly replied with a ragged burst from her upper starboard guns, so close that her shot went high over the frigate's deck, and the burning wads came aboard, so close that they could see the faces glaring from the ports a biscuit toss away. For a moment the two ships lay broadside to broadside. Through a gap torn in the Marengo's quarter-deck bulwark, Jack saw the Admiral sitting on a chair. There was a grave expression on his face, and he was pointing at something aloft. Jack had often sat at his table, and he instantly recognized the characteristic sideways lift of his head. Now the Marengo's turn carried her farther still. Another burst from her poop carronades, and she was round, close-hauled, presenting her stern to a raking fire from the frigate's remaining guns. Two more were dismounted and one had burst, a fire that smashed in her stern gallery. Another broadside as she moved away, gathering speed, and a prodigious cheer as her cross-jack yard came down, followed by her mizzen and a gallant mast. Then she was out of range, and the surprise, though desperately willing, could not come round nor move fast enough through the sea to bring her into reach again. The whole French line had worn together. They hauled close to the wind, passed between the converging lines of Indiamen, and stood on.
"Mr. Lee," said Jack. "General Chase."
It would not do. The Indiamen chased, cracking on until their skysails carried away, but still the French squadron had the heels of them. And when Lenoir tacked to the eastward, Jack recalled them. The Lushington was the first to reach him, and Captain Muffet came aboard. His red face, glorious with triumph, came up the side like a rising sun, but as he stepped onto the bloody quarter-deck his look changed to shocking astonishment. "Oh, my God!" he cried, looking at the wreckage fore and aft. Seven guns dismantled, four ports beat into one, the boats on the booms utterly destroyed, shattered spars everywhere, water pouring from her lee scuppers as the pumps brought it gushing up from below, tangled rope, splinters knee-deep in the waist, gaping holes in the bulwarks, fore and mainmast cut almost through in several places, 24-pound balls lodged deep.
"My God, you have suffered terribly! I give you the joy of victory," he said, taking Jack's hand in both of his. "But you have suffered most terribly. Your losses must be shocking, I'm afraid."
Jack was worn now, and very tired. His foot hurt him abominably, swollen inside his boot.
"Thank you, Captain," he said. "He handled us roughly, and but for the George coming up so nobly, I believe he must have sunk us. But we lost very few men. Mr. Harraby, alas, and two others, with a long score of wounded, but a light bill for such warm work, and we paid him back. Yes, yes. We paid him back, by God."
8 foot 3 inches of water in the well, if you please, sir," said the carpenter, "and it gains on us."
"Can I be of any use, sir?" cried Muffet. "Are carpenters, bosuns, hands to pump?"
"I should take it kindly if I might have my officers and men back, and any help you can spare. She will not swim another hour."
"Instantly, sir, instantly,"
cried Muffet, starting to the side, now very near the water. "Lord, what a battering!" he said, pausing for a last look.
"Aye," said Jack, "and where I shall replace all my gear this side of Bombay I do not know. Not a spar in the ship. My comfort is that Lenoir is even worse."
"Oh, as for masts, spars, boats, cordage, stores, the company will be delighted. Oh, they will think the world of you, sir, in Calcutta. Nothing too much, I do assure you. Your splendid action has certainly preserved the fleet, as I shall tell them. Yardarm to yardarm with a 74. May I give you a tow?"
Jack's foot gave him a monstrous twinge.
"No, sir,"
he said sharply.
"I will escort you to Calcutta if you choose, since I presume you will not remain at sea with Lenoir abroad. But I will not be towed. Not while I have a mast standing."